Well, good morning, everyone. My name is Paul Weber. You know, I've been hosting teleclasses like this for several years now, and in that time, we've had some wonderful lectures by amazing faculty, and most of the good ones get invited back again and again. And I think this is Dr. Bob Wheeler's fourth time giving a teleclass. By training, Dr. Wheeler is an emergency room physician, and by choice, he is a cruise ship physician. He runs seminars through his company, Voyager Medical Seminars, and has made a special study of noroviruses. I met Dr. Bob a couple years ago when he invited me to give a lecture to his fellow cruise ship physicians in Seattle. He's a remarkable guy and one of the most likable people that I have ever met. He also has 102 slides to get through, so I better shut up and let him get started. To present the Alpha Teleseminar, Strategies for Norovirus Infection Control, it is my pleasure to present Dr. Bob Wheeler. Bob.
Well, thank you, Paul. It's a pleasure to be here today, and I'd like to welcome all of you to this teleseminar. As Paul said, I've been a cruise ship physician for about 20 years or so, and so during the discussion today, you're going to see me going from general topics on norovirus and specific topics dealing with issues aboard cruise ships, but those issues will be able to be applied to any of your environments at home as well. We've got a sea of information to cover today, so let's get started. Let's go to slide two. Today's topics are going to include a close look at the norovirus, of course, and then norovirus infections, and then shipboard sanitation and the vessel sanitation program, disinfectants for norovirus, disinfection procedures for norovirus, and something that I think is often overlooked but is ultimately important to try to prevent norovirus outbreaks is that of proper hand hygiene. Next slide. Viruses, they're very simple life forms. They're ultra-microscopic obligate parasites. They're relatively simple in structure and composition. Essentially, what they consist of is just a strand or two of DNA or RNA surrounded by a protein shell or capsid. And many viruses have a lipid protein envelope. And what's important to remember is that it's the absence of this envelope that can make certain viruses more resistant to disinfectants. Next slide. The norovirus, it's a bug of many names. Norwalk virus, it was originally named after an outbreak in Norwalk, Ohio, that took place in 1968. And since then, it's been also known as Norwalk-like virus, or NLV, or small round structured virus. It's a small virus, it's round, it has a structured surface. And then in 2002, it was given its own genus classification in the virus family Calicivirida. It has at least four different genogroups and has multiple clusters and strains. And the strains are often named after places where outbreaks take place, such as Desert Shield, Mexico, Hawaii, Snow Mountain. And over the past couple of years, there's a prominent strain that we've seen from Farmington Hills, Michigan, that has caused up to about 45% of the outbreaks that we've seen, both aboard ship and shoreside. Next slide. Norovirus is a non-enveloped, single-stranded RNA virus. Remember, I mentioned that the absence of that viral envelope makes it more resistant to disinfectants. It's a small virus, about 30 nanometers in size. It has an infectious dose of as little as 10 to 100 virus particles. Now, that becomes important when you consider that each milliliter of vomitus or stool may contain anywhere from 10 million to 100 million virus particles. So if somebody has a vomiting episode in a public area, they can be spewing billions of virus particles out into the environment. Viral shedding can last for 3 weeks or more. It can survive freezing, it can survive 60 degrees centigrade, and it can survive chlorine of 10 parts per million. And it also has a limited immunity, just a month or two, and then people can pick up the same virus or pick up another strand of the virus. Next slide. Norovirus transmission is classically listed as oral-fecal, but I find that much too simple. When you look at it, it has to enter the mouth, goes to the gut where it replicates, and then it comes out the other end of the alimentary tract. And then from there, it can be spread either through hand-to-hand contact or through the air, or environmental services, or food, or water. Next slide. Now, the CDC took a look at the transmission of norovirus back in 2001, and they found that 39% of the virus was spread via food, and 12% via hands, and 3% by water in all of their outbreaks that they had listed. And then other types of ways that it can be spread is through environmental surfaces or through the air. But what's interesting is that 46% of the transmission type is either unknown or there's no data available. Now, in the United Kingdom, where they have had several outbreaks of norovirus over the past few years, they can say that almost 90% of norovirus is spread from person to person or from person to environmental surface to person. That is, most of it is not spread via the food and water. And aboard cruise ships, almost 100% is spread via the non-food and non-water route. That is, from environmental surfaces through the air or by person-to-person contact. Now, certainly food can get contaminated, and it can get contaminated at the source, particularly shellfish from contaminated water, or contaminated water used for irrigation, or in some developing countries where they use human feces as fertilizer. Food can also get contaminated in the processing plants in preparation directly from food handlers who are harboring the virus. It can be spread via customers who may be using buffet utensils or touching the food in a buffet. And it can also be spread by insects. They're not necessarily infected. It's just that they get the virus on their surface, and then they climb onto the food. And this is, you can see this if you have a lot of flies. Now, the foods most at risk are shellfish, that is, oysters, clams, mussels, and cockles, and ready-to-eat foods that don't require cooking after they're handled, such as salads, peeled fruits, deli sandwiches, finger foods, hors d'oeuvres, dips, and communal foods, such as peanuts or chips or something where people are digging into a bag or a bowl, and if they're not careful with their personal hygiene, they can actually spread the virus to other people. Norovirus water contamination is typically done via improper sewage treatment or overflow. It can also come from surface water such as ponds, lakes, streams, rivers, and reservoirs. Well water can get contaminated. Certainly swimming pool water can get contaminated if there's a vomiting accident or a fecal accident in the pool. And ice, being water, can also get contaminated either from the source or by people handling the ice before it gets to you. Now, one of the issues that comes up often is how the norovirus can spread via the air. And there have been several reports out there to show that it can be spread via the air. This particular slide, slide 11, is a report of an outbreak that took place in a hotel restaurant in the UK. And now on the slide, you'll see some couple of dotted circles. Well, those are ceiling fans, and you'll see a black dot at the table marked 91%, and that is an air vent. And at the bottom of the table, you'll see a dotted line, and that is a wall that partially separates that last table from the others. Well, what happened in this particular outbreak is that a patron, who was marked by the purple square, vomited at a table. And the staff came in, cleaned it up right away, but over the next 48 hours, 52 of the 83 survey respondents reported that they got ill. And so that was a 63% overall attack rate. And as you can see from the attack rates that are listed on the tables, they were higher at the closer tables, and so it was felt that this was consistent with airborne transmission of norovirus. And to look at that, next slide, and to look at this in another way, they didn't really give the distance between tables, but what I did in this slide is I assumed that the tables were about 2 meters apart, table center to table center, and then marked it on this. And so what you can see is that the table that had a 25% attack rate was about 8 meters away. And so that's highly significant. You have one vomiting episode, and one out of four people at that distant table, 8 meters away, end up getting norovirus. And so when you look at how this is transmitted, was it directly through the air, or was it person-to-person contact, or was it environmental surface contamination? Was the dinnerware contaminated by particles falling out of the air? Was the food and water on the table contaminated that way? And factors that determined how many people got sick at each table were certainly the distance from the person who vomited, how much time they spent in the area, and what the airflow was as well. But it's important to note that norovirus can certainly be spread directly through the air. Next slide. This slide here shows an interesting study where there was a hotel outbreak in the UK, and it went on for several weeks. And so what they did is they went in and they did surface testing for the norovirus RNA through polymerase chain reaction testing. And you don't have to look specifically at all the details in this slide, but what's important is that it shows that during an outbreak, particularly an extended outbreak, not only is the norovirus found in the restrooms where you would expect it, but it's found in other places as well, in areas well away from the from the restrooms. And it's found on carpets, it's found on walls, it's found on tables, it's found on countertops. And so when you have an outbreak that's going on for an extended period of time, the norovirus finds its way onto most environmental surfaces. Now, what happens when people do come in contact with the norovirus? Well, it's known as several different things in different parts of the world. In the United States and Canada, people may refer to it as a stomach flu. In Europe and the UK, it's referred to as lurgy or winter vomiting disease. Typically what happens is that you have about a day of incubation period, a couple of days of illness itself, and it's a short-lived illness. It only lasts a couple of days. But in reality, if you've ever taken care of people who have had norovirus infection, or if you've had it yourself, you'll know that it's not necessarily a mild disease for the first couple of days. Next slide. Now, when you do contract norovirus, the main symptoms are diarrhea and vomiting, and lots of it. People may have 5, 10, 15 bouts or more of vomiting and diarrhea within several hours or so. And actually, when you have an outbreak of gastroenteritis, whether it's aboard ship or shoreside, people tend to get diarrhea. And if you have more than 50% of the people also having vomiting, you've really got to consider that norovirus is the cause of this. If they don't have vomiting, they tend to have nausea, abdominal cramps, headache, and muscle aches. A minority of the people have fever. The young and the very old may get dehydrated because they can't maintain their fluid intake. And what's important is up to 30% of the people who are infected may actually be symptomatic. So in an outbreak situation, people have to be careful with their personal hygiene, as we'll discuss in a little while, even though they may not be symptomatic, because they may be harboring the virus. Next slide. Back in the early 80s, Dr. Kaplan, a researcher, looked at the different types of symptoms and how to determine whether or not an outbreak was due to norovirus. And he looked at the duration of the illness was 12 to 60 hours, and the incubation period was 24 to 48 hours. But what he found that was important was that, as I mentioned, 50% or more of the cases have vomiting in addition to their diarrhea. And also the stool specimens were negative for bacterial pathogens. Many people also consider the absence of fever in association with these symptoms is an important indicator for norovirus. Next slide. Now, norovirus detection, years past, they used to use a lot of directed immune electron microscopy of stool samples, or they would look at the acute and convalescent IgG serum antibodies. These days, though, the primary way to test for this is with a reverse transcriptase polymerase chain reaction testing of the stool, vomitous, or environmental surfaces. This is highly specific, highly sensitive test, and helps them do genotyping and cluster identification. There's also another test out there that some of the ships are using these days. It's an enzyme-linked immunoadsorbent assay test that can be performed. It's a bit easier to do than the PCR testing. The problem is that it's only sensitive, it has a sensitivity of only about 70% if you have six or more tests, although the specificity is still quite high. Next slide. Now, the norovirus infection treatment, since it is typically a self-limited disease, is more or less symptomatic therapy. That is, PO or IV fluids, antispasmodics, analgesics, antipyretics. People typically get over this within a day or two. It may go on for a day or two more. But usually after a day, their symptoms are gone. But it doesn't necessarily mean that they're not still infected, and we'll talk about that later. Now let's go on to the next slide. Now, 2002 was an important year, at least for me, in looking at the norovirus. Now, in 2001, the Vessel Sanitation Program reported 7 shipboard outbreaks of acute gastroenteritis, and 3 of those were due to norovirus. In all the years before that time, you would usually see somewhere between 5 and 10 outbreaks of acute gastroenteritis aboard ship. Well, what happened in 2002 is things totally changed. All of a sudden, we saw 23 shipboard outbreaks of acute gastroenteritis. 12 were determined to be due to norovirus. 9 others were unknown etiology. So in excess of half and probably more of the outbreaks were due to norovirus. But despite what the media was reporting, and I'm sure most of you read about the issues aboard cruise ships regarding norovirus, and despite what our passengers were saying, and despite what their attorneys were alleging, next slide, it really wasn't our fault. And the reason I say that is that we also saw similar increases in norovirus shoreside, as shown in slide 21. We saw an increase in hotels, restaurants, theaters, hospitals, nursing homes, daycare centers, schools, dormitories, military barracks. We saw it on trains in Ontario. We saw it in buses going to Branson, Missouri. And we saw it on aircraft bringing people over to cruises from the UK. Next slide, slide 22. And in fact, norovirus accounts for 2/3 of all acute gastroenteritis in the United States, as well as 33% of the hospitalizations and 7% of the deaths due to acute gastroenteritis. About 8% of the population in the United States develop norovirus each year. That's almost 25 million cases. But in 2002 and 2003, the incidence of cases aboard cruise ships was only about 0.025%. Now, that's 1 out of 4,000 passengers aboard cruise ships, as compared to 1 in 12 of the general population in the United States. Next slide. Now, if you're going to try to prevent norovirus outbreaks from taking place, you have to understand the virus. And so it has some critical characteristics that you have to keep in mind. One is that it's highly contagious. 2, there are multiple modes of transmission, that is, food, water, air, environmental surfaces, and person to person. It's stable in the environment. We know it can last for 3 or 4 weeks in the environment. It's resistant to routine disinfection methods. People can have asymptomatic infections, and it has people have limited immunity, as I mentioned, only a few weeks or months. Next slide. So like in any other biological outbreak or disaster, what you're going to need is a prevention plan, a surveillance plan, and a response plan. Next slide. Now, shoreside, you have different agencies that may help you try to prevent these outbreaks, maybe local agencies, county agencies, state departments of public health, national organization guidelines such as yourself may provide. In the cruise industry, we have the Vessel Sanitation Program, and it was developed by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in 1975 in order to minimize the risk of diarrheal outbreaks. It also assists the cruise industry in the development and implementation of environmental health programs. Next slide. It has environmental health officers who twice yearly do unannounced comprehensive food safety and environmental sanitation inspections of vessels with a foreign itinerary that call in a U.S. port and carry 13 more or more passengers. Now, that number of 13 is important because if you're a commercial vessel that's carrying less than 13 passengers, you can be considered a cargo vessel, and therefore you're under different regulations, whereas if you have 13 or more passengers, then you're considered a passenger vessel. Next slide. The VSP also provides ongoing surveillance of gastrointestinal illness aboard cruise ships, conduction and coordination of outbreak investigations on affected vessels. They also provide food and safety environmental sanitation programs for people within the cruise industry. Next slide. They also provide consultative services for the shipbuilders in building new ships and They provide dissemination of information to the public. If you want to get more information on the Vessel Sanitation Program, you can go to their website that's listed on the slide and in your handouts. And you can actually download the Vessel Sanitation Program manual. And I think it's very helpful, even for people who are not involved in the cruise industry, to take a look at this, because it shows you the very strict criteria that the cruise industries must follow in order to provide safe environments aboard cruise ships. Next slide, slide 29. Now, the VSP inspections. I know that a lot of you might be involved in public health inspections at restaurants or hotels or whatever at home. Any of you that are associated with a hospital, you know what it's like to have the accreditation council come in and take a look at your hospital. Well, it's similar with the VSP inspections. It's based upon a 100-point scoring system. A score of 86 is considered satisfactory. And what they do is they look at the safety of the water supply, the food supply, the hygiene practices of employees. Next slide. They also look at equipment maintenance, dishwashing procedures, waste disposal, public restrooms, pest and toxic substances control. Next slide. One of the important things with for the medical staff aboard a cruise ship is dealing with the issues of reporting gastrointestinal illness on board. And what we do on board the ship, that we look at we report anybody that has diarrhea, and that's defined as three or more episodes of loose stool in a 24-hour period or vomiting plus one of the additional symptoms, as you can see in the slide. Next slide, slide 32. And we have several logs that we have to keep updated, and it's our responsibility as medical officers aboard the ship to have these available whenever the Vessel Sanitation Program inspectors come on board. We have a gastrointestinal illness log where we list anybody that shows up to our infirmary who can be classified as having gastroenteritis, as noted on the previous slide. We list anybody that receives antidiarrheal medications who may not meet our criteria, but are just looking for something. So that way we can track to see how many people even have a single episode of diarrhea on board the ship. We provide gastrointestinal illness questionnaires. Every time that we come into a U.S. port, 24 hours prior, we have to provide the Vessel Sanitation Program with a gastrointestinal illness report. We have reporting thresholds of 2%. If we have 2% of our passengers or crew or combined who have symptoms associated with gastrointestinal illness, then we have to report that to the Vessel Sanitation Program just to let them know that something may be happening. And at the 3% threshold, what happens is that there's an obligatory inspection by the Vessel Sanitation Program agents. And whenever there's an outbreak going on or a persistent outbreak, then the passengers and crew all receive questionnaires prior to boarding to determine whether or not it's being brought on board the ship from outside sources. Next slide, slide 33. So in looking at prevention and surveillance for norovirus, it's very important that you have a norovirus awareness, that it is highly contagious, it has several modes of transmission, it's stable in the environment, it's resistant to routine disinfection methods. Some people can have asymptomatic infections, and people have limited immunity. Now, on board the ship, we're very particularly about the shipboard sanitation, including food, water, and air, living quarters, public areas, and waste disposal and pest control. And from my viewpoint, one of the important things that we do is also the disease surveillance and reporting by the shipboard medical staff. Next slide, slide 34. So what happens if your prevention plan doesn't work, but through your surveillance you know that you may have an outbreak starting? And so what you need is a response plan. And included in any response plan for an outbreak such as this, you have to consider isolation of the patients who are afflicted, containment of the outbreak, disinfection of the virus that's involved, investigation and try to determine where it's coming from, and then providing information and education for both passengers and crew members aboard ship, or for people shoreside, say, who are in a hotel, a restaurant, or in a community that's being affected by a norovirus outbreak. Next slide. Now, aboard ship, what we do regarding isolation is that we confine infected crew members and passengers to their quarters for 3 days after their symptoms stop. So if they're sick for a couple of days, then they have to stay in their cabin for about 3 days. Now, this is easy to do with the crew members. It's a little more difficult to do that with passengers because they don't want to spend their entire cruise, restricted to their cabin. Some of them are also given the option of disembarking them from the ship, but this becomes controversial because if you have somebody who you consider may have norovirus and you're disembarking them from the ship, say in a foreign port, then even though you're paying their way home and everything via the cruise lines, you're potentially introducing norovirus into that port or into a hotel where they may be staying. And so this is very controversial over what we should be doing with these people. If there's a spare cabin available, we can consider relocating unaffected cabin mates. But the most important thing, in my viewpoint, is that we have to provide instruction on appropriate personal hygiene, especially hand washing. Now, why is that so important? Next slide. Well, this is a very interesting study by Rocks in 2002, where they looked at 99 people infected with norovirus, and they did PCR testing. On day one, they found that only 78% of the people were positive for norovirus RNA. Now, this is important because you've got a 12% false negative rate here. But the important number here is at day eight. It's 7 days after the onset of symptoms. Now, remember that I said that lots of times what we will do is we will restrict people to their quarters for 3 days after their symptoms stop. So let's just say that they get sick on day one, they have vomiting and diarrhea for a couple of days, so that's day two or three, and they're restricted to quarters for 3 days. So we're looking at, on the sixth day or seventh day, now they're able to go out and do their job on board the ship. Or if they're a passenger, they may be restricted to their cabin for a day or two and they're out on board the ship. What's important on this slide here is at day eight, 45% of the people are still shedding the virus in their stool. And so that if they're not careful with their personal hygiene after they go to the restroom, they potentially can be contaminating surfaces or food whenever they come back out into the environment. And then if you look at day 15, which is 2 weeks after the onset of symptoms, 35% of the people are shedding virus. And even after 3 weeks, 26%. So even though people are over their symptoms, there's a significant number of people out there that may have the potential to spread the norovirus for 2 to 3 weeks after their symptoms stop. Next slide. We try to contain the outbreaks. We restrict access to soil contaminated areas until cleaned and disinfected. Remember, I mentioned that norovirus can become airborne in droplets when somebody has a vomiting episode, and it showed that in that restaurant study in the UK where people who were 8 meters away got infected by the virus without any direct contact with the person who was ill. And so what we do on ships is that we utilize specially trained and equipped hit squads or SWAT teams who are sent out for any vomiting incident or diarrheal contamination incident that takes place on the ship. Now, I know that in a lot of different medical facilities, you have different code systems, just like we do on ships. You have a code red for a fire. You have a code blue for a medical emergency. Well, it's come to the point on some ships where they even have a code brown for these incidents that take place aboard their ships so that we can get these SWAT teams to the area as quickly as possible. Now, the norovirus SWAT teams, you can do this any way you want, but this, I've sort of simplified this here. You just take a 2.5 to 5 gallon bucket. You include all your gloves and mask and gown and safety glasses for universal precautions. You take your disinfectant along. You may take some absorbent powder or gel, paper towels, alcohol-based sanitizers, and some red plastic biohazard bags along with you. You want to, next slide, slide 39. You want to cordon off the contaminated area. You spray disinfectant directly on the gross contaminants because you don't want to start cleaning this up right away because if it becomes airborne, you can actually spread the norovirus quicker that way. And once you spray it, you cover the area, wait for 5 or 10 minutes, dwell time so that the disinfectant can take effect. And then after you clean it up, you clean the surface of the gross contaminants, and then you spray it with the disinfectant again, as shown on slide 40. And then after that, you want to dispose of the vomitus and stool in a safe manner. And then afterwards, you want to make sure that the person who's doing the cleaning cleans their hands with soap and water, preferably, or an alcohol-based hand sanitizer. Next slide, slide 41. Then you can open the room to outside air. You get some dilution of the air if there's any virus particles in the air itself. Soiled carpets and upholstery can be steam cleaned after chemical disinfection. And it's best to air dry rugs and furniture if you can, because the ultraviolet irradiation has an adverse effect on the virus itself. Next slide, 42. Other issues of containment aboard ship. We provide medical evaluation for those who are ill with active vomiting and diarrhea in an area of our clinic that's away from non-afflicted people who come in to the infirmary, or you'll see the afflicted people in their cabins. You don't want to have people sitting in your waiting room who are vomiting, contaminating other passengers or patients. You want to make sure that you adhere to universal precautions whenever you're seeing these people, because you don't want your medical staff to become ill as well. And what we do on board ship is we waive charges for our medical services whenever there's an outbreak. There's two reasons we do this. One, make sure that anybody who has any gastrointestinal symptoms comes down to see us so that we can find out exactly how many people aboard ship are ill. And two, it sort of helps to calm their anger a bit, too. And so they will handle the outbreak a lot better if they're not being charged for their medical services. Next slide, slide 43. You want to promptly bag and clean soiled linens or dispose of them as hazardous waste. I always advise against the use of public restrooms, you know, because whenever you have an outbreak, the more people that are using a single restroom, the more the chances that these people are going to contaminate the restroom and that other people are going to become infected. And then what we do aboard ship is we halt intership crew transfers, because we don't want to have a crew member who's going from a ship that has a known outbreak, who may be harboring the virus, going to another ship and infecting another ship in the fleet. Next slide, 44. You want to remove any potentially contaminated food, beverages, and ice from service, just in case that the contamination may come from the food itself, or if it's become contaminated by people who are ill on board ship. And what we typically will do is we'll close the self-service buffet lines, or change them to a served buffet line, or change the serving utensils every hour or so. Next slide. Now, before we talk about disinfectants for norovirus, what I want to talk about is why you have to be so particular in choosing disinfectants. Now, the norovirus cannot be grown in culture. So efficacy testing for disinfectants for norovirus is usually done using a surrogate virus, and typically the feline calicivirus virus, which is a similar non-enveloped single-stranded RNA virus. Next slide, 46. And this is just gives you an idea of the disinfectant levels necessary for various pathogens. Now, the hardest pathogens to disinfect are bacterial spores. And if you look at the non-enveloped viruses, such as norovirus, it's the intermediate to high type of disinfectant level that you need, as compared to the enveloped virus, such as coronavirus, and a coronavirus causes SARS, or influenza. These envelope viruses are much easier to disinfect. Next slide, slide 47. Now, this is a study from Dultry where he looked at disinfection agents that were effective against the feline calicivirus, or FCV. And what he found to be effective, though, glutaraldehyde and iodine, these are not things that you want to use on a lot of surfaces around a ship or your hospital or your hotel, but he did find that bleach or hypochlorite at 1,000 parts per million was very effective if it was freshly reconstituted. But if you use off-the-shelf household bleach, it required 5,000 parts per million. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes. He found that quaternary ammonium compounds, ethanol, and detergents were ineffective agents against FCV, and presumably for norovirus. Next slide, 48. He also looked at heat and activation of FCV, and for complete inactivation, you needed 70 degrees centigrade for 5 minutes. Next slide, 49. He also looked at the surface survival of dried FCV, and he found at room temperature, 20 degrees centigrade, it could last for 3 to 4 weeks in the environment. Next slide. 50. Galati also did this interesting study where he was looking at the efficacy of different compounds against FCV, and he found that mixed phenolic compounds were effective, but at a higher concentration than typically used at the time. He found that liquid bleach was effective at 5,000 parts per million, and this was consistent with Dulcher's findings, and he too found that quats were ineffective. Next slide, 51. He also looked at some fruit and vegetable sanitizers that are in common use to see if they were effective of norovirus. And at the typical concentration, they were found to be ineffective, but at four times the normal concentration, they were effective. They found that hypochlorite liquid bleach was effective at 5,000 parts per million. But the interesting thing is that water alone produced a 2-log reduction in the FCV. Next slide. Now, when considering disinfectants for norovirus, what you want to consider are efficacy. Is it going to kill the bug that you're trying to kill? What's the spectrum regarding other types of pathogens? What's the versatility? How many different forms does it come in? Is it easy to use? What's the safety profile? And what's the cost? These are all things you want to consider. And also when looking at this, next slide, 53, and also when selecting a disinfectant, it's important to consider the product's entire formulation, not necessarily the prime ingredient. Because as we'll see with some of the products I'm going to discuss, many of these have a synergistic effect of one compound to the next. And so it's very important to look at specific disinfectant agents. Next slide, 54. Now we're going to take a look at several disinfectants that have proven efficacy against feline Killisi virus and so presumably against norovirus. And these are going to include accelerated hydrogen peroxide, a mixture of chlorine dioxide and quaternary ammonia, hypochlorite or bleach, perichloromethoxylenol, peroxymonosulfate, and mixed phenols. Next slide, 55. Now, accelerated hydrogen peroxide, also known as Virox, is a 0.5% hydrogen peroxide solution. It's a broad-spectrum biocide. It cleans and disinfects. It comes as a concentrate, as wet wipes, and ready-to-use liquid. Next slide, 56. It's non-toxic in ready-to-use form. It's environmentally safe. It has a 5-minute dwell time. Now, this is what's listed by the company, although studies have shown that a dwell time of just 2 minutes is effective against FCV, and so presumably against norovirus, 2 minutes. It has a 24-month shelf life, and it may leave an easily removed non-toxic surfactant residue on some surfaces. Next slide. Cryocide 20, or chlorine dioxide and quaternary ammonium, it's a strong oxidizing agent. It's a broad-spectrum biocide. It reportedly has been effective in several UK and European hotel norovirus outbreaks. Next slide, 58. It's used primarily as a spray wipe disinfection and as a wet fog. They use it as either full strength or a 1-4 dilution as a 12-month shelf life. Next slide, 59. Recent studies have shown that it is indeed an effective fogging agent against FCV, both on hard surfaces and on fabric with a 30-minute dwell time. It is safe with most fabrics. It's non-corrosive. It may be mildly irritating to the skin and eyes. One caution is that you have to avoid mixing it with acids or chlorine because you can promote chlorine dioxide gas. Next slide. Hypochlorite or bleach. This is actually why I got started looking at norovirus a couple years ago. When we started to have the outbreaks in 2002 aboard the ships, the only recommendation by the vessel sanitation program was bleach for disinfection. Now, that works out well if you're in a restroom or a galley where you have either tile floors or ceramic or stainless steel surfaces, but it doesn't do very well when you've got carpets and upholstery and drapery and you're trying to clean them with bleach. It's inexpensive and readily available. It should be prepared daily as a fresh solution to ensure that you have 1,000 parts per million effective concentration that is required for norovirus. One thing about bottled bleach, like off the shelf in your grocery store, Zetta can lose 50% of its potency in 1 month. It's sensitive to ultraviolet light. It can degrade faster if it's kept at higher temperature. And so that's why it's always recommended that you store bleach in opaque containers in a cool, dark place. And actually, liquid bleach only has a shelf life of 3 to 6 months or so. So the best thing to do is that if you're going to use bleach as your primary disinfectant, then what you want to do is you should mix it on a daily basis, or you use chlorine test strips to make sure that you've got 1,000 parts per million in your final disinfection container. Next slide, 61. Organic debris reduces bleach's effectiveness. So what you have to do is you have to clean the surface of any organic debris before you start using it. As I mentioned, it's used mainly on hard, non-porous surfaces. It can be damaging to many textiles, and it can be damaging to metals as well. Bleach can produce toxic chlorine gas if combined with certain other chemicals. The one that most of us know about primarily is try mixing it with toilet bowl cleaner. It can be irritating to skin, eyes, mucous membranes, and lungs. And I list here that it used to be known as the gold standard for norovirus and disinfection, but within the cruise industry, it's more like a gold-plated standard because there are so many areas on the ship that we can't use this as a primary disinfectant. Next slide, 63. Now, perchloromethoxyanol is a product known as EcoTrue. It's a low concentration, 0.2% of the active compound. It's a broad-spectrum biocide, cleans and disinfects at the same time, leaves no residue, it's non-staining. It comes as a ready-to-use liquid in wipes, has an 18-month shelf life. Next slide, 64. It's totally non-toxic. It has an EPA toxicity rating of Category 4. That means no cautions, no oral, dermal, or inhalation toxicity, no eye or skin irritation. It's hypoallergenic, biodegradable, non-corrosive, even to the point that it has been approved for use on aircraft. And I didn't realize that in looking at disinfectants that one thing that the aircraft industry is worried about is that using a compound on your aluminum or your airframe that may erode it. And so this particular product is the only one that I know of that has been approved for use on aircraft. Next slide. The way that they can utilize such a low concentration of the active ingredient is that the formulation is actually a nanoemulsion of charged spheres, and you can see in that picture, each of these spheres has a charged particle of the active ingredient, PCMX, that actually helps it attached to the virus or bacteria that you're attacking. Its efficacy against FCV and presumably norovirus is a 30-minute dwell time. They recommend that you use it as a spray, an air dry, or as a fogging agent, either as a cold fog, that is just using it at room temperature, or as an electrostatic fogger where the particles are much smaller and they're actually given electronic charge before it leaves the fogging machine. And so in that point, it helps to stick to the surfaces much better. Next slide. Virkon, or peroxamonyl sulfate, is another broad-spectrum disinfection agent. It has 6 synergistic biocides. It has 1,000 parts per million free chlorine in solution when it's mixed. Comes in a powder form, although the mixed form is a 1 or 2% solution and it's non-toxic. It too is biodegradable. Next slide. It has proven efficacy as a 2% solution on carpet material against FCV. It may leave a fine film on some surfaces. It is an acid solution, slightly acid, so acid-sensitive surfaces require rinsing, and that includes granite, marble, or soft metals such as aluminum, brass, and copper. It has a 3-year shelf life as a powder, and once it's mixed, you can use it for 7 days. Microbac and Microbac 3 are a couple examples of mixed phenols. It comes as a liquid concentrate. It cleans and disinfects. It's mixed with water to a solution of 1 to 28. Next slide, 69. There are some precautions with phenols. They should not be used in food preparation or food surface areas or in areas where infants and young children might be exposed to the solution or its residue. Phenols used to be used a lot in hospitals. One person told me that phenols were what made hospitals smell like hospitals in the old days, but they're not used as much these days. And that is because there are a lot of potential toxicity associated with phenols. Next slide, 70. And that includes toxicity to the skin, brain, kidneys, liver, lungs. Olefinophenol is listed as a carcinogen. Ethylene glycol, which is another ingredient in this particular product, is also listed as a teratogen, and it's hazardous to the aquatic environment. So although it's a very effective disinfectant agent against FCV and presumably norovirus, I think that this particular agent should probably be used in very limited areas. Next slide, 71. So in looking at these agents and other agents, what you want to keep in mind is that you want to make an informed choice of disinfectants. The best thing to do is go to the company or the manufacturer or the distributor and ask them that you want to see information that supports their efficacy claims against FCV and norovirus. And it's also very important that if you're going to use a particular agent widely in your facility or your community, you want to test your surfaces to make sure that it's going to be safe. For instance, in all the ships that use these, if they're going to use a particular agent, what they do is they do testing on all of their surfaces, their rugs, their furniture, their drapes, before they have an outbreak, because they don't want to have an outbreak and start using these compounds widely around the ship, destroying a lot of their surfaces. Next slide, 72. Fogging. Fogging has been used aboard ships and in hotels, particularly in the UK, and what it does is it applies small droplets of disinfectant to the air and environmental surfaces. It's a way to provide rapid environmental surface coverage. It's effective for disinfection of horizontal surfaces in air, but not so good for vertical surfaces, under surfaces, or shadowed areas. That's because you can't get enough of the compound via fogging to those surfaces. You either have cold fogging, that is, particles are sent out at room temperature, thermal fogging, they're heated up, or the electrostatic fogging, as I mentioned before. Next slide. Major uses for fogging has historically been in the livestock trade or in food processing plants, where they clean the surfaces primarily, and then what they do is they provide 15 or 30 minutes of active fogging, and then they leave 45 or 60 minutes for the fog to settle and the air to clear. Next slide. Now, although fogging was used, at least in the States, back in the 50s and 60s for some outbreaks, most health authorities now don't recommend the use of fogging in healthcare facilities. There's a question if there's any difference in the efficacy versus spray and wipe disinfection. A lot of people question the need for full surface disinfection anyway. There's a logistical problem. Where do you put the patients while you're fogging their rooms if the hospital is full? And everyone's worried about potential adverse reactions of people who are already ill to a particular fogging agent. Next slide, 75. It has been used in hotels, cruise ships, trains, tour buses, and airliners, and it has found to be at least anecdotally effective in these particular environments. Next slide, 76. So some ships do use fogging as a way to combat a norovirus outbreak, but it should be considered just an adjunct to thorough surface cleaning and disinfection. It does allow for supplemental disinfection of known and potentially contaminated surfaces. You can get good soft surface coverage. And what we do is we fog the cabin for about a minute, let it stand for at least an hour, and then whenever possible, open the room to outside air. Other methods of disinfection. Aboard ship, we institute enhanced food preparation and food service environmental service disinfection procedures. And now typically in galleys and bathrooms, what you use for disinfection is a 200 part per million no-rinse hypochlorite solution. Well, this is not effective against norovirus. So what we have to do is to bump it up to 1,000 parts per million and then rinse the surfaces with potable water. Disinfection has to go on every room in a hotel, a hospital, or aboard ship. That includes restaurants, bars, lounges, showrooms, casinos, game rooms, library, all passenger and crew public areas, all passenger and crew cabins. Next slide, 79. You want to consider any and all hand contact surfaces to be contaminated. And that includes door handles, push plates, pens, pencils, tables, counters, casino chips. Casino chips provided an interesting problem early on back in 2002, because people initially were just wanting to use bleach in order to clean surfaces. So what they did is they would mix a container of 1,000 parts per million of bleach in a bucket, and they put in their chips. Well, very quickly they found that clay chips do not do well in water, and they dissolve. So what they've resorted to at this point for casino chips that happen to be clay is to just pop them in a microwave until they reach that 70 degrees centigrade for 5 minutes. Next slide, 80. Public restrooms, very important that you clean these aboard ships. With this, an outbreak going on, they'll have people going around on an hourly basis and cleaning out all of the public restrooms. Indoor and outboard facilities, as noted in slide 81. And children's areas, the only people that are at worst at personal hygiene than adults are children. And so you want to make sure that the children's areas, whether you're on board ship or in a daycare center, shoreside, you want to make sure that these areas are cleaned with an appropriate disinfectant. Steam cleaning, you know, there's a lot of carpets aboard the ships or in hotels, a lot of expensive furniture. And so in order to be effective for steam cleaning, you have to have a 70 degrees centigrade for 5 minutes at the contaminated surface in order to be effective against FCV or norovirus. And this is hard to do. You know, a lot of the steam cleaning machines will get up to 80 degrees centigrade, but due to very rapid evaporative, conductive, and convective cooling that takes place once the steam is there, it's unlikely that you're going to have 70 degrees centigrade for 5 minutes. And so it's very important that you consider chemical disinfection of soiled areas prior to the steam cleaning. Next slide, 83. As part of our investigation of outbreaks, we do a detailed food intake history for the 72-hour period prior to the onset of illness. We do both passive, that is people who are already sick, and active surveillance. We also interview people who are not sick, but we want to get survey results from people from the entire population. It helps us identify potential index cases. We collect samples of stool, vomitus, and blood samples when necessary. And we develop epidemic curves to help us take a better look at the outbreak that's taking place. Next slide, 84. Now, this is a typical norovirus epidemic curve. Now, if you look at this particular slide on Cruise 1, and the date is the 18th, you'll see that there were a couple of cases of diarrhea or acute gastroenteritis. Now, keep in mind that even on a ship of 2,000 combined passengers and crew, in a week's cruise, you will see perhaps 5 to 10 cases of diarrhea. And very often this is just due to overindulgence or food intolerance or chronic GI conditions, and very often it has to do with eating off ship. But it's clearly, on a typical week, you're going to see less than 0.5% of the total population will show up with diarrhea. But in this particular case, you'll see a couple of cases the first day, then on the 19th, a few more. And then on day 22, you'll see this sudden surge in cases. This is typically what we see aboard ship and in other environments whenever there's a norovirus. You'll see an increase over a few days, a couple of days, 4 days, and then you'll see a sudden increase in the number of cases. And this has to do with the contamination of environmental surfaces in person-to-person contact. Next slide, slide 85. We provide passengers and crew information that an outbreak has taken place. You tell them what norovirus is and how it is transmitted. You advise everyone to seek medical attention if they are vomiting or diarrhea. We want to make sure that we can see every one of these people so that our surveillance is up to date. If ill, you want them to follow isolation procedures to the T. And the most important thing, in my viewpoint, is that you provide them with instructions for proper hand hygiene. Next slide, 86. Now, contaminated hands are probably the single most common vector for the spread of norovirus. This is the last step in the chain of infection. People have to get the norovirus up to their mouth, and they ingest it. And that last step is typically from contamination of the hands. Next slide, 87. Proper hand hygiene practiced by a majority of passengers and crew members could significantly decrease the incidence and extent of norovirus outbreaks aboard cruise ships. Now, this is consistent with the recommendations of the CDC. Next slide. And also, next slide, the Association for Professionals in Infection Control and Epidemiology. But this is nothing new to your group either. Being public health officials, you know the importance of hand washing. Next slide, 90. One of the most intriguing studies that's been done was reported in 2001 called Operation Stop Cough, and this was done by the U.S. Navy at the Great Lakes Recruit Training Command. It included about 45,000 recruits each year. And what they found then in 1966 was that they had a 90% attack rate within the first few months of coming to the training center of all recruits for simple upper respiratory infection. So they decided to do a study, and what they did in 97 and 98, the recruits were given a direct order by the commandant that they would wash their hands 5 times a day. They weren't instructed how to wash their hands, just told to wash your hands. And so after 2 years, they looked at this study, and what they found, well, first of all, only half of the people actually followed that direct order. They didn't really get to washing their hands 5 times a day. But at the end of 2 years, what they found by just having people wash their hands frequently during the day, they saw a 45% decrease in upper respiratory infections by all of the recruits. Now, you can't necessarily extrapolate this to norovirus, but it does show the importance of proper hand hygiene as a useful disinfection procedure. Next slide, 91. The important thing about hand washing is that it can help break the contamination cycle, recontamination cycle. You know, you'll have a surface get contaminated, and then you can disinfect it. You can, you know, wash your hands, or you can clean a surface or disinfect a surface. But if you have people who are infected and are spreading the virus to the surfaces, the area can get recontaminated. Then you disinfect it again, and it gets recontaminated. And hand hygiene, whether it's washing or using alcohol agents, can be very effective in breaking this cycle. Next slide. Basic hand washing procedure. Wet hands with water, apply soap, scrub your hands for at least 15 seconds, rinse with running water, and dry the hands and turn off the faucet with a paper towel. We all should follow that, but it's not necessarily done, even in the medical establishment. Next slide, 93. Efficacy of hand washing for FCV and norovirus. What's interesting is just using running water has a 2-log reduction in FCV on the hands. If you use soap and water, it's a 3-log reduction. Now, antibacterial soaps offer no significant increased benefit for FCV and norovirus because they're non-envelope virus, and so it becomes clear that the importance of hand washing, at least for these viruses and other non-envelope virus, is the friction in the flow where you're physically removing the virus from the surface. Next slide. Alcohol-based hand sanitizers have become very much in vogue in hospitals to be used as a hand cleaner. A product must provide at least a 2-log reduction in pathogens to be considered effective. Next slide. It's dependent upon the specific agent, concentration, and contact time. Most people, at least in the States and I believe in Canada, are using an ethanol-based gel with about a 70% concentration of ethanol. Next slide. It's important to use the right amount. To use a 10 to 15 second contact time, you need about a milliliter, about a 3/4 inch or nickel size of gel. If you want to have a 20 or 30 second contact time, you want to use about a 1 inch diameter size. Next slide, 97. Overall, alcohol-based hand sanitizers provide a 3 to 4 log reduction in bacterial and viral pathogens with a contact time of 15 seconds. But as I've mentioned, the non-envelope viruses are more resistant and require an extended contact time. The bad thing about norovirus is that even with a 30-second contact time, you only have about a 1 to 2 log reduction. And so it's alcohol-based hand sanitizers alone are not effective against norovirus. Next slide. Hand washing is especially important before eating and after using the restroom. In norovirus outbreaks, alcohol-based hand sanitizers should be considered an adjunct only to hand washing and not a replacement. Next slide, 99. So when do you recommend using hand washing versus sanitizers? Well, hand washing if the hands are visibly soiled, after contact with bodily fluids, before eating, and after using the restroom. And you use hand sanitizers if there's no visible soiling, when soap and water are not available between hand washings and to supplement hand washing. Next slide. It's important that in the event of an outbreak that you have formal education to all crew during the sign-on orientation and via crew TV. Now, if you're shoreside, you can apply this to your staff and employees. You want to provide notices to all passengers in the stateroom and information folders. And you want to have instructional signs in all public restrooms and private bathrooms, advising people that the best way to avoid getting ill is to wash their hands. Next slide. So here we are with a summary. Norovirus is everywhere, and it's a highly contagious gastrointestinal pathogen. The outbreaks can be controlled with enhanced sanitation procedures, and proper hand washing techniques can have a significant impact on the spread of norovirus infection. Well, we've reached the end of the slideshow, and I'm sure Paul's happy to see that. Paul, do we have any time for any questions?
Actually, we don't, Bob. I'm sorry. We've just come under the wire, but I see you've noted your contact information on the very last slide, and by that I'm assuming that you don't mind if people give you a call or send you an email to ask whatever questions they might have.
Yes. Any of the audience, if they have any questions about this, I'd be happy to answer their question by email, and then they can distribute that to anyone else that they'd like to as well.
Excellent. Great. Bob, thank you very much for another excellent teleclass. As always, you're one of the fastest talkers that I know, but it's always very interesting. Thanks very much. Bob, thanks again. And my thanks to everyone for joining our teleseminar today. Hopefully, we'll talk again very soon. Goodbye.